Here's a presentation of the full version of how Candace was able to find the archive of letters from Emma Goldman to her lover, Ben, in the music store in Chicago, and what happened after that. How is it that you came across Emma Goldman as a historical character and as an activist and a revolutionist?
I have to say that I've changed so much since the first days that I came across Emma Goldman. I am what my daughter often calls a 70s mom feminist. And when I was young, I lived in Chicago, went to University of Chicago, and really found that there were no female models. The feminist movement was just taking hold. I wasn't happy with it just being women. I had a sort of a larger vision of freedom that included other people, men, and sort of a gender trajectory that would encompass all of us. And Emma Goldman's autobiography was reissued at that point. And all of us who were activists read it in our spare time, and we passed it from person to person. It was sort of almost like contraband while you were at school to be reading something else like that, especially at University of Chicago. And I was just incredibly inspired by her as a woman, and also because the image of radicals at that time, the historical image of radicals, were like these very one-dimensional, sleep-on-the-floor kind of people, very aesthetic. And here was Emma Goldman, who believed in beauty and in love and in ecstasy and community. And, you know, even though some of the characterizations of the other people are probably wrong, I still had them. And so Emma Goldman represented a very different kind of combination of the love generation and the political anti-war and women's freedom, sexual freedom, and more. So, to make a long story short, when I was teaching in southern New Jersey, I was living by myself in a on an island in the Mullica River. I was teaching at the first year of a school that's now called Stockton in New Jersey, and I was afraid because I was living in the woods, and I got a dog from the pound who was a red Irish setter golden retriever. And I, like so many people at that time, it's hard to imagine, but so many people at that time named their cats and dogs and children Emma in honor of Emma Goldman. I can't, you know, and a lot of those cats and dogs have died, and the children are older. Some of them contribute to the Emma Goldman papers. But so I named my red Irish setter golden retriever Emma. And the reason why I mention that is that and I think it was 1975, when I was in my 20s, I was teaching also at an institute called Sagaris, which was the double-edged sword of the Amazon. And it was a summer institute that was intended to bring all these women's representatives of women's groups from all over the country to study and think together and to try to make sure that the advances that we had made in our thinking were not co-opted by the university, which that's another discussion, which in some ways they have, in some ways they haven't. But and I brought my dog, Red Emma, and on my way back from Vermont, where this Simms Institute was, I drove with a friend of mine who's now my partner in life, he is, and we drove through Chicago from Vermont on our way back to California, where by that time I was going to school in California, in the History of Consciousness program. And we stopped at a guitar shop where I had a friend who worked, and my dog, Emma, instead of staying at the door, anarchist dog that she was, she bound in right after me and knocked over like so many music stands, and I felt horrible, and I spent quite a bit of time trying to lift them up. And at the same time, my friend who worked there said, "Well, what a lovely dog you have. What's her name?" And I said, "Emma. Red Emma Goldman." And he looked at me in the kind of quizzical way, and he said, "This is going to sound strange, but 5 years ago in the back of the shop, I think I saw some letters from Emma Goldman." At which point, I don't know, I didn't really absorb it. I just waited. And he came out shortly afterwards from a storage room with a box, a huge boot box, shoe boot box, full of letters from Emma Goldman to her lover and manager, Ben Reitman. And I have to say that I, for all the education that I had had in my life, I had never seen an original letter. I had not ever seen Emma's handwriting even, which in itself was quite interesting and fun. I think now that you can see so many things online, it's a different experience for a new generation. But at that time, you really had to go to an archive to be able to see these kinds of original things. And the idea of finding it in a music shop was just almost unheard of. And he was a very sweet guy, and he sent me and my friend to Xerox the letters if we wanted to, and that was so exciting. And I started to Xerox the letters and started to feel incredibly embarrassed, because I suddenly realized that these were love letters that I had never known about. And I knew from Emma Goldman's autobiography that she had said that one thing she said is that Ben was the most passionate of all the relationships she'd ever had in her life. And I remember that she had said, "His letters were like a narcotic to me. They made my heart beat faster, but they put my brain to sleep." And so I got it. But in her autobiography, you would think that she had just transcended any kind of turbulence in their relationship. But from these letters, suddenly the woman who spoke about free love and jealousy, its cause and possible cure, which was always to leave the door open, these letters were full of jealous rantings at Ben Reitman, who was so promiscuous. And in one of the letters, it said, "My jealousy turns me into something foreign to myself. How can I speak of freedom when I myself have become an abject slave to your love?" And it was easy to read full letters, because at that time Xeroxing was so slow. I felt like I was doing something wrong by even looking at them. At one point, we got to a letter that said, "If anyone ever saw these letters, I'd feel naked before the world." At which point, I stopped Xeroxing.
Because he knew she was talking to you at that point.
I thought she was finally using get away. This is not for you. This was not intended for you. But then, you know, when I came back to Santa Cruz where I was, you know, at school, I started to look at the other letters and I actually saw one letter that said exactly that the letters were, if the, ever the letters were published, it should be after her death. So that was also interesting, and I started to think about her as a person whose philosophy, her political philosophy, was not just external but internal as well. And so she strove to be the great example. She wanted to live out her values. And in a way, these letters were like a little, you know, like a little secret peek into the fact that it wasn't easy for her either. But all the time I just kept them wrapped in a Chicago Maroon, one of the university newspapers. And at that point, and then the, a little bit later, the, but a little bit later, the owner of the guitar shop called me and said he was going bankrupt because the shop was closing. Would I be interested in purchasing the letters? And I felt like I had to keep them a secret, but I literally had no money to do it. And I started, actually, Jessica Mitford, the author, lived out here, and she was one of the friends of a friend of mine, and she said, darling, we must do it. And we started to collect money to buy the letters and essentially hide them. At which point, an archivist from the University of Illinois at Chicago, at that time on Circle Campus, called me frantic and said, you can't buy these letters just for yourself. And I said, well, Emma doesn't want anybody to see them. And they said, essentially, au contraire, we have hundreds of letters very much like that. And I had a very kind head of the department then, Hayden White, who gave me money to go see the letters at in Chicago. And sure enough, they did, just as Emma said, breathe the same sad song of love and whatever. I don't know all the letters by heart. So at that point, I thought that they were right, that if they were already, if many of them are already public, then maybe what I should do and could do is to write about that part of her life with great respect, as instead of having people scoff at it like they might have done during her life, just to say, here, Emma is like the rest of us. She and her struggle is worth learning from and knowing, and it makes her less distant and more, you know, more intimate sense of what her life was. And so that was the beginning of writing Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, which was a book that was also my thesis. And I, in the end, I thought that what maybe one of the messages was that her, at that time, I felt like her vision was so one-dimensionally difficult to achieve. And I thought that it was a challenge to all of us, like, how can you hold on to your vision, not let go of it, but not set yourself up for the agony, the constant agony of not being able to actualize it in your own life. Like, where is that slippery slope? How do you do that? And I guess I thought that the letters that I read of Emma Goldman's were so sad that I, you know, wanted to show that she transcended that. She transcended her own sadness for to continue to serve, you know, to serve as a spokesperson for a vision of a better tomorrow, essentially. One of the kind of kinky things about the letters were that she signed all of them Mommy, almost all of them Mommy, and wrote to him as, wrote to Ben Reitman as her hobo. He actually was a gynecologist and a hobo and a very colorful figure who was, he was also a gynecologist to prostitutes and people on the rails. And consequently understood female sexuality, which was not insignificant in her relationship to him. But I thought at first it had to be wrong, that maybe these were not the right letters that she signed at Mommy, but lo and behold, she was 10 years older than he was. And they played with that idea that she was his mommy. So there's much to say about it. So when the book came out, it made kind of a big splash everywhere. I mean, almost everywhere. Lots of languages published in lots of countries, published reviews of it, where the only thing I could understand in their reviews were Emma Goldman, Candace Falk, and Fuck Talk, which was terrible. Sorry, did that on your radio.
No, that's okay.
I'm sorry, but that wasn't sweet.
It's pre-recorded, so I can edit that out.
Okay, so sorry. So, but many, many feminists were very, very upset because they felt like I was, you know, how many great heroines did we have? And I was showing her Feet of Clay, and why did I care about this part of her life? It was, you know, but it was the moment of the personal as political. And so some people loved it, and some people were horrified by the book and lots of racy passages in it. And the original one came out with Holt, Reinhard Winston, and actually the paperback is about 100 pages shorter with Rutgers University Press. May not have as much of the racy stuff, but it still comes across. Many anarchists, however, had a very interesting reaction to it because they worried that it didn't say as much about anarchism as it did about her personal life, that it was kind of this view of her that didn't make her principles exactly clear and the history around it exactly clear. And I have to say that my editor pressed out a lot of those things and really wanted me to stay focused on this kind of love story as a way to bring people in to being interested in her and her ideas at all. If I could do it again, I think I would have not only had passages from her letters to Ben Reitman and to the other people in her life, but also much more of her talks and her philosophy, which one thing I learned from this is that, you know, some people were really hard on me, and they didn't give me a chance to grow. And if anything, I feel like the Emma Goldman papers, which was, you know, essentially brought to me by the National Archives Act, looking for somebody to preserve her papers in for the National Archives, because people in the 70s complained that all the National Archives cared about were the great white men and the founding fathers. And so in the course of collecting, organizing, identifying, creating a 22,000 document microfilm guide, and we've now done 3 selected book editions. We've transcribed and footnoted, annotated anything that you might not understand. And I have written these like elaborate introductions that put it in a context so you can understand the fuller story. And my colleague Barry Payton did a brilliant job both with the annotations but also with the directories of individuals and publications and organizations. So I feel really proud of these volumes that we've done, the first 2 with the University of California Press and the second 2 with Stanford University Press. The last one, as in the fourth, is not out yet because we had a terrible funding crisis. And also there's a paperback with the University of Illinois Press for Volume 1 and Volume 2. So essentially, coming back to the original point, I definitely feel like I have learned so much and been able to transmit so much interesting and important and respectful information about the history and philosophy and people who were part of and affiliated with anarchism and the Demogorgon in that time, that I'm kind of a different person than I was when I began. And I feel like everybody doesn't get a chance to round out their earliest work to create it as a whole. And when I say that, I have to say that although we call our microfilm of 22,000 documents a comprehensive microfilm, I'm very aware of the fact that nothing is comprehensive and letters keep popping up, and we really have almost double the amount of material in our office now. And our volumes are selected volumes going from 1890 to 1901 as Made for America, and 1902 to 1909 Making Speech Free, 1910 to 1916 Light and Shadows, from her statement of Light and Shadows at the Avant-Garde, and now on 1917 to 19 are the war years when she is on trial, in prison, and deported. So I still am aware of the fact that those books are selections, and people can, there you could do, I don't know, thousands of other studies coming out of this. And one of the things that it's hard to imagine right now, but when we were first assigned to do a microfilm edition, that was the only way to get material that was secreted away in archives all over the world to be democratized so that a university or research place could purchase the entire microfilm so that researchers and students and activists didn't have to travel to Amsterdam or to France or to Germany or to Michigan or New York to see her material. And also this collection put it all in order, so that you could see everything in context. Now, we are hoping, beyond hope, I refuse to finish until we digitize at least our microfilm so that you can all have access to everything just from a computer wherever you are. we want to do it in such a way that it'll be completely free, that it won't be locked away in a university subscription. And also because the second part of Goldman's life beyond the American years, when she was in Russia and Europe and Spain and Canada, are fascinating and full of fabulous material that is yet to be, you know, is yet to be seen by many people. So I feel proud of what we've done, but I also feel worried because, you know, maybe I should never have expected anything else, but this, we've been so marginal, and I didn't realize that our initial grants from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission and some from the National Endowment for the Humanities and other large foundations would not last, and that our affiliation with the University of California was so tenuous. And so there's something about being completely in, like, you know, from head to toe into a project like this, and really wanting it to be complete and out there and not wanting any institution or lack of money or anything to stop it. So that in the tiniest, tiniest little way, we have at the Emma Goldman Papers a sense of how hard Emma's life must have been. And then I'm saying we're like a little speck on the map of that, but still we get what it is to struggle to keep that kind of project afloat and moving forward. And in that sense, I should also say that our project is completely collaborative. From day one, it was collaborative. It always makes me feel a little weird because I'm the quote-unquote founding director, editor, and I often use the word director because, you know, the way people treat women, it's like, you know, you're the editor, you're the bottom editor or something, and I've had to represent the project to so many different places. But in fact, there have been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who have had a hand in either finding the material, identifying the dates, doing the research, even cutting the edges off of copies to making headers, to making indexes, to, you know, also to bring our work to a larger public, so that we've done three different high school curricula and posters and an exhibition that we speak to so many archivists and researchers and activists who have been part sometimes of the paid staff and very often of the volunteer staff. So, you know, right now we call ourselves Team Emma, and it really is a team. And so, essentially, when it's just my name associated with it, it's really a mistake. In the last years, Barry Pateman was an incredible associate editor. And the years before that, there were other people who worked on the microfilm and the guide. And so I'm proud to say that it is, in fact, in that way, not completely, but very much in the spirit of collaboration.